This is a very familiar passage, familiar chapter, Luke 15. It's the burden of, or the, most of the chapter is on the prodigal son. But I want to read the first part. Now the tax collectors and the sinners were all drawing near to hear him, that is, hear Jesus. And the Pharisees and scribes murmured, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." Now Jesus apparently knew what they were talking about, and he's going to address himself to how you deal with sinners. And he uses a couple examples that are designed not to shock them too much. But then he comes with the story of the prodigal son, which obviously will shock them. But I want to say just a word for the Pharisees. I remember Mark Twain saying that he'd like someday to do a brief for the devil. He said nobody's defending him much, and he's being maligned a great deal, and he said it goes without saying that someone who has 80% of the human race under his rule and 100% of all the political leaders must have something to be said for him. So Mark Twain said, "I'd like to do a little brief for the devil sometime." Well, the Pharisees are a malign group, as we know. But the fact of the matter is that they were the law and order group. Now, usually in a group like ours here, a sprinkling of Democrats probably among you, we're likely to take law and order with a bit of demeaning, as if that's not very important. But law and order has always been important, and the Pharisees really represented the defense of law and order in their day. And not just law and order represented by the Roman laws, but by the best traditions, and they were pretty rigid traditions, of the Talmudic law, the law that the Jews themselves were governed by. And I think I've known people who in our modern day would be Pharisees, have a good deal of the Pharisee in them, and they're generally awfully good people. They're probably the people I rely on most to keep things going in the church. And they're the group that probably we depend on most to get things going in a community. They generally are substantial people. And they have respect for the solid values that hold society together. And I guess probably without being aware of it, we who are of the established church, or probably of the middle class in our society, we have a lot of that in us too. Now, I think of the disfranchised, those who are different from me, and those who have probably broken the law and are at loose ends and are not very attractive. I suppose when I think of Christ's admonition to me, I can say, well, I'm all for them, but I just soon not have them around much. Supposing one day I, as a pastor, meet one of my parishioners, and in rather enthusiastic way he said, "Pastor, I know I met a person that I think you ought to meet and we ought to have in the church, and could you arrange to meet me at lunch tomorrow, and I'll make you acquainted with him." And that's all he says. Now I think if I'd give this some thought, I'd say to myself, well, I suppose he's an attractive person. Probably he's a banker. Or a person you know, whom we ought to have in the church. Maybe he's a good tenor, and we need him in the choir, and probably got a nice family, and all of that. So that's what I live with. Until I meet, at noon the next day, and he takes me to the jail. And he introduces me to a man who's there for embezzling, and who is an alcoholic, and whose life is generally a mess, and who, in addition to having a messed up life, is not very repentant about it. He's sullen, he's bitter. And I kind of say to myself, what kind of a trick are you playing on me anyway? I thought you said you wanted me to meet a person whom we ought to have in our church. You see, I'm the Pharisee too. I'd probably like, I'd say, well, let's get a hold of Lutheran social welfare instead of taking him on direct. We're really not equipped in our church. You see, our pews are cushioned. So there's just no question about this business of being with sinners. And Jesus was with them. Now I think I'd have to say that as a Christian, as a citizen, as a, quote, a Pharisee, I ought to testify to the importance of law. I mean good regulations. You're not supposed to kill and commit adultery and steal and embezzle and all of that rot. You know that. And let's say I'm with people who do it. How do I react? Well, I probably make fairly sure that I'm not going to be with them. Or I exile them. I don't want to throw them in jail, but I hold them off. I'm not so sure. They're breaking the rules. A missionary friend of mine from Japan said one of the great curses of the missionary movement in Japan was that the Christian movement got identified all the time with don'ts. These are the people who don't swear, who don't drink, who don't go to shows, who don't do this and don't do that. And the whole weight was on the don'ts. And there was a sense in which, I suppose, In a society that, I don't know Japanese society well enough, but in a society that doesn't have the traditional rules and ways, we tend, coming there to be Christ's representatives, to come down rather hard on the law. And when finally Jesus... When the high priest said, better that one man die than a whole people perish. Now that could mean, number one, that if Jesus were allowed to live, he'd stir up agitation so that the Roman soldiers would come and kill a lot of Jews. But I think there's a deeper meaning, that if Jesus is allowed to run free and ignore the laws, these laws are the ones that have held the people together. These are the fiber. This is the fiber of our society. And if he's allowed to gather leaders, we'll probably disintegrate for want of someone who stands firm for these traditions of ours, these laws of ours. And I'm sure that when Paul went to be a missionary to the Gentiles, this wasn't like being a missionary to the Rotarians. This was like being a missionary to the outcasts, those whom you wouldn't entertain having in your gang, in your company. So that he had a real problem when he came back to Jerusalem and tried to defend himself as a missionary that should be accepted by the Jewish Christians too. It's hard for us to imagine the situation that prevails over against this phenomenon of the Pharisee. Poor guy. I suppose he wanted to love. Many times he wanted to love, but he couldn't. Because how could you love someone who was breaking the law? That would mean, if you showed love for him, that you were in effect saying that the law wasn't important. And we get caught with that. Plenty of us get caught with that. Well, I'll come back to that. But Jesus said, I'll tell you a story or a parable. What man among you, having 100 sheep, if the 99 in the wilderness, leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? Well, everybody nod his head and say, I sure would. You know, I don't want to lose a sheep. And when he found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost. Well, they understand that. Just so I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Then he takes another. That probably puzzled them a bit. Takes another example. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, doesn't light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it? And when she's found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the coin which I had lost. Just so I tell you, there's joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Now, everybody would agree, yes, as far as sheep are concerned and coins are concerned, that's right. That's what we do. But now he comes to the rougher one, and he said, there was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me that share of the property that falls to me. And the father did. He divided his living between them. Now that, I'm sure, a lot of responsible, law-abiding, defending of the society and of the family would not concur with. That in such a cavalier fashion, the father would give him what he asked. He'd rather react and say, well, he could have probably bargained with him, given him a fourth. But here he wants the whole business, and he gets the whole business. Now that says something about the Father, and of course it says something about what he's saying is about God, that God respects the freedom, takes long risks on freedom. He has given us freedom, and he respects that freedom. He's not going to take it away. He's going to trust way beyond any reason for trusting. Now, probably there are a few fathers who would go quite this far, and therefore a Pharisee would say, well, that's not right. That's not right. That's not using your head or even being reasonable. But, of course, he's pressing a point about a heavenly father here, and not about just about earthly families. And this gift of freedom is a frightening gift, just a terrible gift. In many ways, it would be much nicer. This poor guy who went and squandered it and got into such a mess, he would not have gotten into that trouble if the father had not respected his freedom, but withheld it. Now, some of you have read the brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky's, and the Grand Inquisitor, that interlude, the scene in Seville, Spain, where people are being killed as heretics. And the Grand Inquisitor is a 90-year-old cardinal, and he examines a person in the faith. And if he finds that he doesn't have the right faith, off goes his head. Those were cruel days. And one day, while executions were being carried on, and the people, the families were there grieving, and there were curiosity onlookers to watch this beheading process, suddenly Jesus appears, and everybody recognizes him, and he consoles the grieving and comforts those who are about to die, and the people report this to the cardinal, and the cardinal orders Jesus arrested and thrown into prison. And at night, the cardinal comes to talk to Jesus and says to him, "Tomorrow you will die as the great heretic." And then he went on to say, You made some grave mistakes. You turned down the wise one 3 times in the desert. He offered you a chance to rule people by the dough, by bread, by magic, by spectacular things, miracles, or by sheer force. And you turned him down on every score. And what you're asking of people is the free response of their hearts to you. And they can't stand that. You have asked too much. And we have to scale down your demand. We correct your work. We give them rules, and they obey the rules and disobey them. And then we absolve them from their sins, and they go back to the rules. And they're happy. They don't have to try to give you the gift of freedom. They can give you obediences with the rules. And the old cardinal said, there are only a few great saints who can give you free love, the love from freedom. And you cause the rest of the people to suffer and be in despair. And what we do is to correct this. Now, that means, of course, the cardinal said, that after a while there'll be one kind of unambiguous mass going through the motions of obedience and disobedience and absolution and all this. Well, he carries on, talks like this to Jesus for some time. And then he said, "Say something to me." There's a silence. He's through talking, and he said, "Say something. You know, deride me if you must, but say something." And Jesus gets up and walks over to him and kisses him on the cheek. And the cardinal throws open the door of the cell, and says, "Leave and never come back." It's a tremendous little it's not so little, probably 70 pages. The first time I read it, my spine just tingled. And I've read it since, and I get pretty much the same reaction. This frightening gift of freedom that he's given us. How comfortable it would be if he hedged us in with a neat set of rules. And then we could disobey the rules now and then and get absolved and be back in favor, instead of giving us this frightening gift, freedom as sons and daughters. Well, that's what the Father is. He won't stop you. He won't stop you. You can go straight to hell, and he won't stop you. You have the power to hold him off. It's a frightening power, the freedom that we have, to turn him down forever. But that's the freedom he's given. And that's the point, I think, of this rather senseless thing that the Father did. Capitulate, it seems, right away and say, "Okay, here's half of the estate. Go and do what you want." But so we have to understand that what Jesus is saying is something that's kind of radically against the whole structure of rules at that time. Now, when the boy goes, not many days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and took his journey into the far country, and there he squandered his property and loose living. Well, that's too bad. He could have, I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a second edition of this parable? And that the young man had gone to the far country and he'd invested in the best stocks and bonds, and as a shrewd businessman, he had become the tycoon in the far country. Most powerful and rich man in all the country. And then one night, under the glittering lights of a great banquet thrown for him, people fawning all over him, he came to himself. And he said, "I am not worthy to be called his son. I will go to my father. I don't belong here." You see, the point really of the parable, profounder point, is that he left his father and the far and his home, and he went to the far country. Now, if he had succeeded in the far country, by the standards of the far country, would this have been laudable? Would the father getting an invitation to the banquet say, "Wonderful, he's really made it, my boy has"? That's not the point of the story. Now, we lived in Duluth, Minnesota for 3 years, and the postmaster was a Mr. Barrett, and he gave me a book. He said, I think I'd like to have you read this book. It was Paul de Kruijff's The Seven Iron Men. I don't know if any of you in your generation has read Paul de Kruijff, but he had a number of little interesting books. And this was the story of five Barrett brothers and one of the brothers' sons, the Seven Iron Men, who from 1880 to 1890 explored the whole North Minnesota area for gold, for silver, or for lead, and they found and copper, and they found none. But they found some red stuff lying on the surface of the ground that was 60% pure iron. They had taken options on vast tracts of that Mesaba area, so they had it under control. And then they began developing a railroad, but they had to sell stock. And the people in Duluth didn't care to buy stock. They didn't have much faith in this. So, in the midst of building the railroad, they asked John D. Rockefeller for a loan of $1 million. He refused to loan it to him, but he said, they wanted to sell half their stock to John D. Rockefeller for $1 million. He refused to buy, but he said, "I'll loan you $1 million, which he did, and took security in all their stock, in the whole business. And there was a short depression in the years of Cleveland, I guess. Anyway, they couldn't pay him off, and Rockefeller foreclosed and took the whole business. Now, these seven men had spent a decade exploring this area and getting a hold of it, and now they had nothing. And Mr. Rockefeller sold that stock to U.S. Steel for $80 million. And U.S. Steel valued it a few years later at $228 million. Now, John D. Rockefeller made it in the far country, and the Barretts didn't. They were impoverished, in other words. Now, when we say that a man has made it, it could be very well that had the young man made it in the far country, he would have been fully as unethical, immoral, as his squandering his money on riotous living. The point of the parable, after all, is not whether you succeed or not in the far country. The point of the parable is that you were in the far country. I'm not making a judgment at this point over against John D. Rockefeller. It was kind of the thing to do in those big industrial baron days where there was no income tax and where life was rather ruthless. But I must point out again that it's the being in the far country, away from God, that is the important point of the parable, and not how he managed, ill or well, in the far country. You think that over. C.S. Lewis has a little statement where he says that there are three things necessary for the successful voyage of a fleet of ships. One is that the ships are ship-shaped, each one, so that it doesn't drop out of formation as you go. The second is that they don't collide with each other, but stay in formation. It'd be too bad if they all ran into each other. But he said, if every ship is in good shape, and no ship collides with any other ship, that is, if all of us are, you know, are fulfilled, whatever language you want to use, in good shape, and we don't fight, we get along, nation doesn't fight against nation, there's peace and well-being. Mr. Lewis said there's one more requirement, that if the fleet was supposed to have gone to Liverpool and it lands in Rio de Janeiro, the whole business had gone wrong. If we were able, without God, to organize life in such a way that every person had a PhD and every person had money and no nation fought any other nation, so that we were all, you know, we were all in good shape and at peace, the world a huge, sophisticated pigsty, every pig grunting aesthetically, and no pig in want, so that he jumps on another pig. If we could organize the world like that, the whole world would have gone wrong, and the angels in heaven would weep over a whole world that had miscarried. Because the point is not that we have God in order to have PhDs, in order to have peace, and in order to do this or that, or to avoid squandering our stuff in riotous living. No, we don't have God in order for anything. God is the end of the game. Having him, we have enough. The fact of the matter is, he hasn't promised anything else. You ever thought of that? He never promised anything else, really. He promised himself, and he gave himself. He could have given everything else in the whole universe at no cost to himself. He just got so much surplus around, and there wouldn't have been a dent in his celestial budget. But he gave what did cost. He gave us himself, which cost him a death on the cross. Now that means that the important thing is for us to be with him, however that's defined. And I think that's the point of the story, that he went to the far country. Now so he gets in trouble. Got to be a famine. He ran out of money. Joined himself to one of the citizens who sent him into the fields to feed the swine. And apparently the boss said, don't eat that food. He would gladly have fed on the pods that the swine ate. And no one gave him anything. I don't know what he got for a salary, but they even resented his eating the stuff that the pigs ate. So he was in a bad shape. Then he came to himself, and he said, how many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, And I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. He had rehearsed that speech. He arose and came to his father. But while he was yet at a distance, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants. Father interrupted him. He never did get a chance to offer to be a hired man. The father interrupted him and gave orders to the servants to throw a big party. Now, he met him with compassion. Let's examine that for a minute. Now, the Pharisees, I think, wouldn't dare to have compassion or to show compassion, let's say, under those circumstances. Let's change the circumstances just a little. Supposing the boy had gotten into deep trouble in the far country and somebody had sent a message and said he's in bad shape. He's in the prison hospital. He's practically fallen apart, and he's sullen and mean. Will you come? And the father comes. Now, at that point, he shows no sign of repentance. What would the father's attitude then be? Would it be one of compassion? Will you come? And the father comes. Now, at that point, he shows no sign of repentance. What would the father's attitude then be? Would it be one of compassion? Now, there are three things the father might do in a case like that. First place, he might lay it into him and say, you've broken every law on the catalog. You know that, don't you? Or in the second place, he might say, can you understand how hurt your mother and I are? Or in the third place, he might neither have reminded him of the law, or struck that note of paranoia over against the father and the mother, but had straight compassion. No talk about breaking the law, no talk about the pain that he's caused others, but just the fact he's in bad shape. And at that point, he needs compassion far more than he needs the law. He needs compassion far more than he needs to be reminded whom he has hurt. And that's where you've got God. He always meets us with love, with compassion. Wouldn't it have been a pity if the father, at the time the boy had come home, had said, well, you've kind of made a mess of things, haven't you, son? And the son would say, well, after all that, I'm repenting. Well, that's kind of nonsense. But let's say he doesn't say that. But he said, I've come home, Dad. And his father said, well, I'm glad you're home. But I hope you've learned your lesson. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put you up in the hotel for 6 months, and if you make it, you can come back home. Well, that'd be sensible. You know, shouldn't you expect him to show his colors and to prove that he's repentant? Put him on probation. But there was no inkling of that. Just none at all. It was almost an ignoring of the whole episode, of his having squandered half of the estate, of his having lived a life of riot, a life certainly that the father couldn't possibly approve. There was just no talk of that at the moment. There was just an unconditional acceptance of him. And then a throwing of the party. Now, I think that a Pharisee, you and me, whatever Pharisee we've got in us, would like to do that too. I can think of a good father. Let's say a good father. He's tried to bring up his family with the good values. And then one of the kids just... And makes a real mess of it. And let's say he lands in jail. It's going to be pretty difficult for the father. Not to... be somewhat restrained in his love. If he gives his love lavishly at that moment, hasn't he in effect destroyed the very values that he's tried to inculcate? And that's the tension. That's just the tension. Something in him wants to give his love more than ever before, because, poor kid, he needs the love more than ever before. But something in him will say, my goodness, this isn't the occasion for it. After all, he's broken every law in the book, really. And isn't that important? So there is that tension. And the church has that tension. My goodness, but we have that tension. We're supposed to be the conscience of the nation. To defend, to articulate and defend the great values that hold society together. The preaching of the law, if you will, as a guide for necessary structural living. And yet the church has the great task of proclaiming the love of God, which sweeps away everything except love itself. So you've got the tension right within the church. You've got it right within your own spirit. There's just no question about that. But I remember Nora's father, who was a pastor. I at the time I was in the ministry, the question, I think, we had certain ecclesiastical standards that were rather firm. I know that one pastor said, I would never marry a divorced person because the Bible says it's wrong. But we had certain, still certain, precepts that they were rather neat, that divorce, the marriage of a divorced person was legitimate if the person were the innocent one. And if the offense was either adultery or desertion, some of you remember. I asked and I had a number of cases of people who had been divorced who came to ask if I would marry them. And I asked my wife's father one time, "How do you handle that? How did you handle it when you were a parish pastor?" Well, he said they were always difficult. But he said, I had one simple rule. I would rather make a mistake on too much mercy than too little. But you see, the tension was there. I was, as a representative of the church, to defend marriage and not to treat it casually. At the same time, I was under a mandate to love, to show mercy. And when Jesus said, judge not, that you be not judged. And when he said, vengeance belongeth to me, I will recompense. Let me take care of the spanking. You just be nice to him. That's about what he said. And I think of Portia's speech in The Merchant of Venice, you know, talking to Shylock. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven to the ground beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesses those who give and those who take. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. And mercy doth thus then show likest God, or power, or the monarch, crown, I guess. Is then like God when mercy seasons justice. Well, one last thought They made merry. This was a joyous occasion. I won't get to the poor older brother, because we were cooked before then. That's a whole chapter in itself. They made merry. Now, supposing this younger son had been sitting by his father during the banquet, and while they were having the gayest time, celebrating this marvelous thing that my son who is dead is alive again, my son who is lost is found, and he's invited everybody to be gay and merry. And supposing the son sits there and says, "Dad, it's a wonderful thing really to be back home." I'll tell you, thinking back on that pigsty and how hungry I was and how dirty and how terrible it was over there. And the father would say, "Just forget it. Forget it." And let's say he joined in the singing and the merriment for a while, but then he came back to the subject. "Gee, it was awful there, Dad. I'm so glad I'm away from there." Well, if he kept on doing that at the banquet, after a while the father would be quite unhappy that he should dredge up his past when the father was just covering it all with joy and merriment. And he would say, "Now, boy, just forget all about that. It's all in the past. Just put it out of your mind, because this is the time for joy and this is the time for merriment." And that we forget sometimes, that we have a right to put the past away and to be swallowed up in the joys of the kingdom. Any of you remember C.S. Lewis's statement that joy is really the end of the game? Probably more than love. It maybe comes just a little higher. It kind of crowns love. That supposing, he uses this illustration, supposing on a given evening a few couples who like each other just happen to drift, just accidentally drift together in one of the homes. And they sit all evening engaging in small talk, sometimes opening up and sharing a little of their, letting each other look in to their souls a bit. But it's not calculated at all. The talk just flows. And they just enjoy each other, that's all. And then when midnight call they go home. And most of them feel just a little guilty. What have they accomplished this evening? They forgot to talk about the United Nations or about any great issue. They never passed any resolutions or wrote any minutes. They really did nothing, just nothing, except by chance, really. This wasn't programmed either. By chance, enjoying one another. And Mr. Lewis says that's the reason God keeps the whole show going. Springtime and harvest, governments, schools, churches, families, the whole bit is just kind of a stage setting for this sort of thing happening, where people just enjoy one another, and that's all. And he implied that that's the nearest thing to heaven that we can think of. That heaven will not be a place where you'll have Bible classes or staff meetings or anything of utility, apparently, but a place of unalloyed joy. And that's what the banquet is. "Come and have and rejoice with me. Bring the best robe, put it on him, put the ring on his hand, shoes on his feet, restore him to full rights. And let's eat and make merry, for this my son is dead, was dead and is alive, lost and is found. Well, most of these thoughts you have thought of yourselves. And that's as far as we go. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow. Good night.